You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this lovely Monday evening here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, broadcasting live from the Star Worldwide Network's studios. And it is now officially the second quarter of the year. You have successfully completed the first 25% of your 2017. So I hope you got 25% of your goals wrapped up and finished. It's time to sit down and listen to a little rock and roll conversation with a local singer that claims he isn't a star yet, but he's been on TV more than most guys in this town that think they're stars. The very humble and talented Mr. Stephen Christian is with me in the studio, and he'll be with us right after we play a cut from one of his favorite groups when he was growing up. And this record came out in 1976. I was in high school, and loved this band. Spent a lot of time listening to him back then. So here is Detroit Rock City from the band Kiss. First time on the Otto D Show.
Listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
That was fun to hear. I remember that record. I haven't heard that in a long, long time. That's the first Kiss song I think I've played on the show in 90 some odd episodes. So welcome to the show, Kiss. And tonight, the guest, my guest is Stephen Christian. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Otto?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming on the show and chatting with me.
Thanks for having me.
So this was a big record for you.
It's a life changer, game changer. Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about it. How old were you when you heard this record?
Well, I should probably give you a brief bit of backstory.
Sure.
In 1975, I was living in Carson City, Nevada, and I saw a commercial on TV for Kiss coming to Las Vegas. And as a kid, I don't know what this is. I'm trying to comprehend. It's like an evil clown circus. There's exactly. blood, and there's fire, and there's makeup.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is. A year later, we moved to northern Idaho, and the neighbor kid across the street invites me over. And it was, I want you to hear something. And he puts on Destroyer, and he will not show me the cover because he doesn't want me to be judgmental.
Right.
As soon as he put the needle down, he couldn't figure out what the noise was, the intro there with the spoken radio thing.
Right.
And then it finally
kicks
in. Yeah,
I kind of skipped over that intro. Yeah.
Right. So when Detroit Rock City kicks in, I mean, my life changed. I mean, I'm so used to, you know, the Carpenters and John Denver, flavor of the month on AM radio back in the mid-70s.
Right.
So when I hear this bombast coming out of these speakers, my life is just like, oh my God, what is this? This is amazing. I can't get enough of this. And after about the third song, when God of Thunder rolls on, he shows me the album cover. It's like, oh, it's that evil clown circus.
It's that evil clown circus.
So I loved the music before I ever knew who I was associating the image with.
Mm-hmm. And you remained a Kiss fan, I imagine, for a long time.
Still am.
In fact, you have another interesting Kiss story we'll get to, which is fascinating. But since we started in Nevada in 1975, let's kind of go back from there. Where were you born?
Anaheim, California.
Okay, so tell me about growing up in California.
I know nothing about it because we moved on my third birthday
Perfect.
To Carson City.
Okay, so you really grew up in Nevada.
Yeah, well, about 4 or 5 years of my life was spent in Nevada.
Okay, do you have a lot of folks that still live back in Nevada or California in terms of relatives?
I don't have any relatives. My grandparents passed away who were in Bakersfield. Probably my childhood best friend, Mike Davis, still lives in Carson City to this day. And thanks to Facebook, we've reconnected.
Oh,
and then
cool.
his mom, who used to babysit me, we've also reconnected as well through the Facebook thing, which is great.
Awesome. And so you left Carson City then after a few years, too. So you're still pretty young when you left Nevada.
Very young, yeah.
And then where'd you go from there?
Northern Idaho for probably about 10 years. And that's where a lot of my friendships really began.
Okay. Well, let's get back to this hearing this Kiss record in 76 when you were in Nevada. At that point, had you played an instrument yet? Were you into music at all? Any level?
No. All I know is when I heard that drum intro come in, I was like, I want to play the friggin' drums.
I want to do this.
Yeah.
And so at that point, you hadn't played the drums. When did you start playing drums?
1980. I was collecting Star Wars things at the time, you know, figures and cards and all that. And I sold everything at a yard sale to buy my first drum set. I was like, damn it, I'm doing this rock and roll thing one way or the other.
Right. Now you moved, so that's quite a couple moves for being such a young man. Was your father job changing or was he in the military or what was your hopping around?
No, he's had one job since he was out of high school where he worked for somebody else. And ever since then, he's had his own businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd moved up to northern Idaho, and they really fell in love with the lake. So we had a house on the lake, and he had different businesses at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of to fend for myself, I guess, because he would put me in baseball camp one year and then soccer camp and this and that. And I'm just not a sports guy.
Mm-hmm.
And music I discovered kind of sort of on my own, so I embraced it, and I raptured in it. And that was my thing. You know, for better or worse, it became mine.
So you were you grew up in Idaho, basically. At least you were there for 10 years, about?
Yes.
So did you, you're playing drums up there, because you started playing a few years after you were there, a couple years after you were there. Did you have any bands in Idaho?
Just a little thing I started with some friends, just messing around.
Played some local shows?
No, because I lived way out in this town of like 106 people, which was 15 miles away from another town of 4,600 people. And I would have to get a ride into town on weekends from my folks to jam with these other guys. Just start noodling around. We never had a bass player, kind of sort of didn't really have a singer. Nothing ever really started because in a town that small, there's very few people. You find somebody who has a bass. Hey, just come jam with us. It doesn't matter what you like. Just come jam because you have a bass.
Yeah, that wouldn't really fit real well.
Yeah.
So then anything exciting happened in Idaho before you left the state? As we scoot along through the biographical memories.
I mean, just a lot of solid friendships to this day.
Do you have a lot of brothers and sisters who come from a big family? Or
I have two sisters. I have no brothers, but they both have a brother for some reason.
Okay, I know how that works. So any musicians, either of them?
No, just okay. me.
Just you. So you were the first one in the family.
My grandfather on my father's side, he played the fiddle. Mm-hmm. But that's about it.
So was playing drums a bit of a rebellion in the family? Were the folks behind it or against it? Or how did they feel about this?
I think they just kind of let me do it, because when we lived in the town of 106 people, I practiced in this garage, and it was kind of at the bottom of it.
It kept
me out of trouble, more or less. And it was on the downslope of this hill, and my parents would get phone calls sometimes from people who lived up on the hill going, "Your son's playing drums again, isn't he?" Because it would like reverberate through that garage door up the hill.
Yeah, or across the lake.
Exactly.
If it was on the lake, I would imagine. So you came to the Metro Phoenix area in about 1986?
January of 86, we moved here. Yep.
Okay. And you were working for your dad?
I started working for my dad when I was 13, when I lived in Idaho. Okay. He purchased a fishing lure company called Max Squid, and we ran out of a garage for several years till he sold it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've worked one job or another since I was 13. I've always been a worker.
Right. We have that in common, working for our fathers. My dad was in the construction business, with floor covering company. You would set tile and, you know, all that stuff, and then go play in rock bands on the weekends all the time.
Was that here or back in
That was
Indiana?
Actually back in Illinois.
Illinois, okay.
Where I was originally from. Man, this is a long time ago.
Yeah.
But so I came out here in 89. You were out here in 86. And you mentioned that your father had always had his own businesses, and earlier you mentioned to me that he had a record store here
in town. We had actually purchased a record store I had worked at part-time for about 10 years. It was called Rockaway Records.
Yep.
It was pretty renowned here in town. They dealt with a lot of collectibles and autographs and things of that nature. And they put the store up for sale, and we looked into it and decided we were going to do this. So purchased the store, ran it for about 6 years, and through trials and tribulations, for the most part, the economy really, really hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up closing the store at the end of 2012. And I just sold off all the fixtures and just moved everything essentially into my house, because there's a lot of stuff from the going out of business sale that we still had. I had to figure out, you know, what am I going to do with this?
Sure, sure. Well, it's an odd time to get into the record business when, you know, everything was going digital so fast and the big chains were also in place, you know. But it's interesting that the store stayed open till 2012.
It was strange, because there were like Bashes and Fry's that were closing stores. And when you stop and put this into perspective, like, wait a minute, they sell necessities. We sell luxuries. If a place that sells necessities or food are closing, what is going to be our fate? How long can we hang on here? And obviously it was, and there's places still that are doing well and surviving, thankfully. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Zia chain, there's Revolver Records in Phoenix. I think they have two mm-hmm. locations now. God bless them.
Yeah. Yeah,
Asylum cool. Records in Mesa. There's different places. So,
well, you know, it's a bit like the recording business too, where the studios close, and I was part of that. But also, some people look at that as the thinning of the herd. Mm-hmm. A lot of people get involved in an industry, especially that's kind of fun or they have a passion for. And then when the economy gets tight, it kind of comes down to just the ones that are necessary. And it's a real, like you say, a thinning of the herd. Of course, record stores now, there's a real resurgence in vinyl, so we'll see, you know, what happens there. When did you start playing in a band out here in Arizona?
Probably about 87. I started meeting up with some guys, you know.
Bigger town, a lot more musicians.
Yeah, actually 86 in high school, but then just kind of moving on and things perpetuated into something. Maybe about 89 by the first time I set foot on a stage,
right,
is in a band. I had done what
and
they
you were
called,
the drummer.
Yes.
Okay.
In Idaho, I had done what was called an air band.
Really?
Where you do the lip syncing.
Oh, okay.
I got videotaped.
Oh,
it's hilarious.
I didn't know that was such a thing.
Oh, yeah. Because
I mean, now all the pop stars do it, but back then.
Oh, this was great, because a buddy of mine, he wanted to be a mercenary. So he ordered these mail order catalogs about all these devices and stuff to buy. And he bought this flame shooter. And he didn't tell anybody in the band.
Right.
So we go to do this. And I have a video of it. It's hilarious. We do this show at this high school auditorium. Shoots this fireball off over in the crowd, and it's like, oh my gosh. And then he sets off flash pots, and I thought we were going to get arrested.
I remember those days. We used to make our own flash pots, and
yeah, you could back then.
Trouble. Go to a magic shop and buy, you know, flash powder.
Yep.
You can go to a gun shop and buy gunpowder and mix them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we used to do crazy things. We used to actually was in a band playing in a little community center, wooden building that could probably hold about 50 to 60 people, one room building, mm-hmm. little stage, wooden stage. We're playing our show, and we're dousing the drums in lighter fluid and lighting them on fire. And our bass player had laid a piece of cloth from the kick drum down the front of the stage off the end of the stage and soaked it in lighter fluid or gasoline. I don't know which. And I didn't know he had done this, but he laid it out right before we started. He wanted to light that and let the fire come up to the drums, and then the drums catch on fire. We're 18 years old, and we're just soaking this stuff and playing, and stuff's just burning. You know, we burned a little bit of the stage, but nobody got hurt.
Wow.
But it's like those crazy stories when you're a kid in a rock band and pyrotechnics or something you had to invent. They didn't exist, you know?
Yeah.
It was kind of nuts. Now, you're a great rock singer, but here you were playing drums. Were you singing and playing drums in that band?
I was singing a little backup kind of stuff.
You weren't lead singing then?
No, it was too hard because the way that I physically exerted myself with the limbs and then to concentrate and keep my eye on the tempo and then everything, and it wasn't something that I excelled at.
When did you move for the first time to the front of the stage?
I think it was about 1990 or 91.
And what happened then?
I just decided I didn't want to play drums. I was kind of writing about three quarters of the songs in my original band at the time. And they're very simple 3-4 chord type of sort of songs.
But were you playing guitar at that point too then, I guess?
Enough to get by to structure a song.
Sure.
And
okay.
I would show it to the guys and they would learn it and we would have a vehicle to go and play original shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then they eventually started coming out of their shell and we would all play and write songs. But everybody was growing in different directions. So that was kind of like the catalyst for it not working out in the long run. But I kind of decided after seeing a couple different drummers do some solos at some shows, some national guys, I'm never going to be to the level that I aspire to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm already kind of interested in this songwriting-ish kind of thing. And I just kind of went that direction.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the name of the band? Was there an official band that you fronted and sang then?
Not back then. Oh, I was a drummer in a band called Webb with two B's.
Okay.
And it was about maybe a dozen shows, just a little, you know, Mason Jar, After the Gold Rush, Backyard Party, whatever kind of sort of band.
So the singing kind of took over.
Eventually. When I first started, a buddy of mine that I used to be in a band with, a guitar player, he heard me. And this is very green in my years of getting started, like the first year. He says, I think you're a better drummer than you are a singer. And to my ears, it was discouraging, but it's like, well, you know what? Is anybody really as good when they start? I'm like, no, I got to keep at this for a while and give it a shot.
Yeah, you really do. And it's interesting because you've done some really cool stuff as a singer. You've had some great opportunities. And so it kind of brings me back to a story we mentioned, your Kiss story. You ended up singing with Kiss, kind of.
Well, yeah. Thankfully, there's video to prove it, and it's on YouTube.
Well, tell me what happened, because that was fascinating.
Kiss was doing what they called an official Kiss convention, and they were going to play hotel ballrooms around the country for 1 year. And they came to Phoenix, and they allowed people to bring video cameras into this thing. So we went, because a friend of ours had a public access show. He couldn't go and wanted us to film some segments and kind of host and edit this little thing for him that he would piece together. So we went, and there's a portion of the program where Kiss had come out, and they asked him to turn on the lights, and they had everybody sit down on the floor. So it was kind of like hanging out in Kiss's living room.
Mm-hmm.
And about three quarters of the way through this little stripped-down acoustic performance Kiss was doing, Paul Stanley addresses the crowd, "We want you to sing with us." And we're thinking, oh, okay, the Kumbaya, rock and roll night, whatever, we'll clap our hands and sing.
Right.
Well, we're sitting there, and Gene Simmons' assistant at the time, Spiro, comes walking through the crowd with a wireless microphone.
Right.
A buddy of mine named Eric Blum, who's sitting next to me, works for the California Angels, knows nothing about music. He raises his hand, goes, "Hey, over here." And he hands him the mic. I'm like, "What are you doing? You don't sing." He sticks the mic in my face. And I'm like, I don't need to be told twice. And I grabbed that mic, and I stood up, and I just let it go.
That is too funny.
Yeah.
So then what did you sing?
I sang the second half of King of the Nighttime World.
Which is off of that same record, actually, the Destroyer album that we played Detroit Rock City from.
Except I did the Alive 2 ending where Paul hangs out the end with this vibrato. I'm like, I'm not letting go of this moment till it's really time to go.
Right.
And I let that vibrato go, and the crowd erupted. It just floored me. And then you see the reaction on their faces. And Gene asked me, "That's a great intro to Heaven's on Fire. Can you sing that again?" "Who, me?" "Yeah, you. Can you sing that?" "Okay." Gene Simmons asks, you don't question it. And I sang, you know, first half of that, and we started passing the micro, and I wanted other people to sing too.
Sure.
So it's like, I had my moment. It was great.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And in fact, you mentioned to me just before the show that someone came up to you and asked for your autograph after that.
Yeah. Look, I'm a nobody. I'm just a guy who does music, and once in a while something happens that's kind of cool. And I'm there where Kiss is. People paid $100 a piece to get into this 12-hour convention to see Kiss.
And you stole the show.
I had a moment in the show.
True.
And it was very bizarre for me because several guys that I looked up to, like Greg Chason from Badlands, who's actually kind of like my big brother now, Robert Mason, who's now in Warrant, and the guys in Kiss, while I'm singing, they're all eyes affixated on me, and I'm just thinking, I've bought every one of your guys' records and seen you on concert, and for this brief moment you're looking at me. It's a very bizarre feeling. I would hope everybody would get an opportunity like that to get what it feels like, because you can't even describe it.
Right.
But, yeah, somebody asked me for an autograph, and I was thinking, why would you want my autograph? Because I sang for like 2 minutes, and I didn't sign it because it was a Kiss poster. I'm like, I'm right. Not in Kiss. Why would I? It's not that I don't want to be appreciated or acknowledged. Yeah. It's cool. It's just I'm not in Kiss.
Right. I find it fascinating. I think it's interesting because, again, you know, some people, I guess we don't know our talent or what we have, especially if you're as humble as you are, until somebody comes up to you and does something like that and says, I want your autograph. And what they're really saying is, you know, you touched me, or they're saying, by being next to you, I'm right next to them. I'm so excited to have this moment. Can I have your autograph? You know, that you were that big to them in that moment. And it's interesting because fans have a relationship to performers or artists that's different than we do to our friends. In fact, if Gene Simmons was one of your best friends, you'd never be impressed by the fact that he's anything. He's just one of your buddies who right. happens to be in Kiss. But when you're just a fan, he's like, oh my God, that's Gene Simmons from Kiss. There's this separation that we do to those we admire, you know? And when you're a performer, there's always people that you admire, but there's always people that admire you. And I know as you do shows in town, and I do shows in town, there are people that come up to me that I don't know, that I'm sure are Facebook friends, but I don't know them. And, you know, they give me a big hug, great show, blah, 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 blah. And I'm sure in regular conversation, they tell their friends that, you know, that I'm their buddy, I'm their friends, because they can reach me, right. you know. But if they did reach out to me, I'm like, who are you? I don't know who you are, you know, because it doesn't go the other way. I might perform, but I don't necessarily get to interact with everybody on that basis. It's an interesting thing to transcend as a performer, to start to recognize and then respect that adoration from a fan. And one of the things I found really interesting in talking with you before in our corresponding about the show was the respect that you do have for people that come out to your show, and how you reference the fact that if they've chosen to invest their time in coming through that door, you know, that impacts your thought process, how you feel about them. And a lot of artists don't have that.
Absolutely. I mean, when you have all these multitude of choices of where you can go, invest your time, buy a ticket, clap your hands, whatever, and they choose you,
yeah.
that says they either like, respect you, like what you do, want to know more about you, or hear more from you, whatever. That's respect. And it's like you should at least be able to reciprocate and appreciate the fact that, wow, someone chose me and us and what we're doing to invest their time and tell their friends.
Yeah.
That's big. That's huge.
That is. Now, one of the things that you and I have in common is that we do these impersonating shows. I do this John Lennon show, and you do a Sammy Hagar show.
That's what I've been told.
And we're going to get into that, but before we do, I want to back up just a little bit and play a tune of yours that's an old song.
Oh, goody.
And now I've heard you sing, watch these clips, a couple other ones that I want to talk about when we get to it. You're a badass power rock singer. You've got a lot of power and a lot of authority up front on the stage. In fact, what's funny is that a little event you did singing with Kiss in front of those guys, including their representatives, is the kind of opportunity that puts you on a short list in somebody's memory bank, going, when an opportunity comes up and they need a guy, they're like, hey, remember that one guy? Remember that guy that did that show that sang? I mean, you get on that list in a sense in their mind. And that's where a lot of opportunities come from, you know, just being able to get in front of an audience and do the thing you do. And you never know who's in the audience.
That's true.
But going back to this record that I want to play, this recording, it's called Got to Find a Way. I believe it's not released. Is that accurate, or was it released?
It was released.
Oh, okay.
It was self-financed. I did this record back in 98.
Oh, that's right.
Actually, Dave Pratt had played it. And I got a call from Larry Mack, who was working at KPD at the time. And he says, Dave is playing your record. He really likes it and this and that. And I had come down like a couple days later. I brought this big giant bag of bagels. And I just walked in the door. And he jumped out of his chair. He dropped his newspaper and he jumped up and shook my hand. I've never met the guy before. I'm like, wow, you know who I am? I'm just some dude coming to say thank you.
I know, but what's funny is you keep thinking of yourself, how many years ago was that? Even back then, you keep thinking of yourself as I'm just some dude. Well, you're just some dude just like everybody else is just some dude. But the truth of the matter is, the some dude you are has this talent and brings this joy to these people via what you do. And that is recognized. And so people are excited to have that, whether it's a broadcaster who's excited to share it or a fan who's excited to take it, in a sense, participate with it. You know, I mean, we're all just people. But we all have talents, and I think that you found yours, and I think fronting a band is a special thing for you. I think that you're great at it.
Thank you.
In this tune, you're not going at it. It's not a heavy tune.
No.
It's mellower. It's prettier. Yeah. And I heard it. I'm thinking, I want to hear one of the badass tunes, you know, from YouTube.
Well, it is what it is for the time,
yeah.
And my energies and my direction was different at that time.
Very stylistic of the period. You can kind of tell. Now, are you the writer on this as well?
I did write this song, yes.
And are you playing the drums on it?
I'm actually just playing some rhythm guitar on it and singing.
Oh, okay, cool. And what was the title of the album?
It was actually called Self-Titled.
Self-Titled.
Yeah.
And as an artist name, was it simply Stephen Christian?
Yes.
Okay. And the tune is called Got to Find a Way.
Find
listening to Otto D. coming at you live.
And I am Otto Daniolo, the host of the Otto D. Show, here with my guest Stephen Christian. And that tune was one of Stephen's called Got to Find a Way. And what year did that record come out?
1998.
Cool. You mentioned to me, you know, we always pull our earphones off when the music's playing and you guys miss out on the conversation, but you mentioned that there was some confusion about your identity when that record came out.
Yeah, see, the name Stephen Christian and the fact that Dan Wexler, who was the guitar player in Icon, one of the two guitar players, he plays lead on like two or three songs on that album.
So his name is on the records.
Right. So there's this Icon association. And Stephen Clifford, the original singer from Icon, mm-hmm. had quit Icon to become a born-again Christian. So there's Christian, there's Stephen.
Stephen
and
Clifford,
somehow,
the Christian.
So when this comes out and I'm touting that the guy from Icon is on it, people immediately are saying, hey, it's Stephen Clifford from Icon. I'm like, no, it's not. I look, sound nothing like the guy. Now people think I'm pulling this ploy to sell records. It's like, oh, no.
That's funny. But you had Danny on it.
Yep.
Talk about a band Icon had their day, man. I think there's some new recording going on, isn't there?
I don't believe I'm at liberty to say much.
I'm at liberty because I don't know. So there.
I talk to Dan here and there. We do some business things together. And, you know, I know he's doing some things outside of what is Icon. There may be something under that tag of Icon, but I don't really know for sure at this moment.
Awesome. We'll keep everybody hoping. Speaking of working with people on things, you do work from home. You have your own little business.
Yeah.
And you're a stay-at-home single parent.
Correct.
So, and you're a musician performing out and about town. I mean, that's a full plate.
There are so many things on my plate. I mean, my plate runneth over, literally. But the great thing is I have the flexibility to do what I need to do, like mm-hmm. to go to my son's school yesterday to meet with the principal and to follow up on some things that had fallen behind on and to take him to the bus stop every morning to pick him up, this and that. I don't have to punch a time clock, but I have this flexibility to juggle and do all these things that I need to do. So I don't know if I've ever really figured out like how many hours I do all these different things. Sometimes it might be more, sometimes it might be less. I can up and leave town when I, you know, need to for gig opportunities or whatever, like, you know, going to mm-hmm. Cabo back in September. We had to go down there for 4 days. That was great. But it's something I've really appreciated that I stumbled into by accident.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't trade it.
So what is your business at home? What do you do?
I pretty much sell on eBay and Amazon for the most part. Mm-hmm. Kind of more or less a digital photographer, do some stuff on the side, but it's primarily eBay.
How did you get into that?
From the record store that we had that we closed due to the economy, I got rid of all the fixtures and I put all this stuff in my house. I'm like, what am I going to do with this stuff? You mm-hmm. know, 200 crates of records, thousands of CDs, T-shirts, tour books, sheet music, autographs. I mean, thousands and thousands of pieces of merchandise. And it's mm-hmm. like, well, I started piecing things together. Well, now I don't have rent. I don't have employee salaries. I don't have insurance, internet, all this. My overhead is
inventory.
But right. So it's like, well, I should probably start selling this, you know, on eBay and Amazon, just, you know, because we already had an eBay and Amazon store when the retail brick and mortar store was open.
Mm-hmm.
But the energies were focused on the brick and mortar at the time. So since things changed, I just kind of reversed and went, well, now I'm going to do this. And that perpetuated into essentially my income.
Mm-hmm. So now do you still focus on record sales through your eBay account, or do you sell all kinds of stuff?
A lot of it is CDs. A lot of it is vinyl. There's so much vinyl that I haven't even listed yet because I'm really particular. I want someone who's purchasing from me through the mail to look at it as if they're holding it in their hand. So I will take a lot of pictures of the grooves, of the label, possibly the matrix, little creases in the corner so they know exactly what they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's time consuming. CDs are usually pretty easy. So I'm trying to get more quantity up to where I have more time later to spend with the detailed things that take longer to list, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Sure. And what about the Amazon store?
Not as much on the Amazon store. There's been problems with eBay and Amazon in different respects. Amazon has a current issue that I don't know if I should say publicly or not. It's caused me a lot of distress.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been another similar symptom with eBay. And I have to call them about literally every other month, and they have to credit me back monies that they're shorting me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it always gets taken care of. It's just the end result doesn't seem to be resolved. And I have to keep investing my time to remind them, hey, you did this again. Mm-hmm. Fix this.
Mm-hmm. Well, besides working at home, which is really cool, and you mentioned going to Cabo last September, you've got a Sammy gig coming up in about a week and a half at a place called Pranksters 2 in Scottsdale.
That is correct.
Tell me a little bit about that show.
Well, I front a tribute band called Sam Halen, which is kind of what it sounds like. It's a tribute to the Sammy Hagar era of Van Halen. And, you know, I don the wig and the glasses and the costume, and we go up there, and I belt it out, and I go through this extreme regimen that other people probably don't do, and some people are just kind of aghast when they hear what it is that I do. But I give everything that I have when I go on the stage. If I know I'm going to land for an hour, I give it everything I got for an hour. I sweat my butt off. If we're up there for 2 hours, I pace myself because I know it's 2 hours. I still give everything I've got. But this is basically, it's kind of a warm-up show with the new lineup of the band that we have. And it's a live video shoot. We're compiling footage because we have some casino opportunities later in this year. And we've got some things planned for later in the year that are really pretty cool. I can't really talk about it at the time. But if people go to samhalen.com, obviously, or watch the Facebook page, they'll find out what's going on.
Samhalen.com. It's pretty cool. You know, I have one of my favorite records when I was young was Montrose. Mm-hmm. And Sam was the lead singer of the band.
Yep.
And in fact, it says Sam Hagar on the back of the record. He's credited instead of Sammy. It's kind of funny. But man, he sounded great way back in the beginning. And that's tough stuff to sing all night long.
It is the most challenging vocal work I've ever done in my life. And when he went into Van Halen, my God, did he raise the bar. I mean, there's some tough stuff in there. If you ever listen to the song Dreams, that is probably the hardest song that Sammy's ever sang. I mean, it is in the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to place it in a certain point in the show to be able to do it. I have to be warmed up first, but it can't be too late in the show. It's just a certain way that it's like, okay, get my breath. We're going for it now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bear.
Tell me about how you met Sammy Hagar, because you met the real Sammy Hagar.
Yeah.
He met you, Sam Halen.
He was filming an episode of that show, Rock and Roll Road Trip, at Cooperstown. And Danny Zalesko's wife, Leslie, had forwarded me the invitation and let me know they were doing the filming thing. So I went down with my son, who was 10 at the time, and I dressed up because I thought, maybe I'll get a picture with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down there, and they were filming out front with Danny. And at some point, Sammy turned around, and the security was keeping everybody back about 15 feet. And he saw me, and he just lit up. Oh, man! And he clapped his hands, and he walked over, and he high-fives me. He grabs me, and he hugs me. And then his wife, Carrie, comes over, and she goes, oh, my gosh, let me get a picture. Pulls out her phone, take a picture. And literally a split second later, the director, the producer from Access TV says, hey, why don't we get him in this promo? I'm like, huh, what? Okay, and action. It was that quick.
Wow.
And that's what happened.
So that, and then they used that in the promo for the show that year.
Yeah, and then it was at the very tail end of the Phoenix episode. It's like the last thing you see before the credits roll.
Right. And then I believe there was a portion of that stuck in season two as well, in the clips promoting the second season of the show.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I think it might have been through Danny Zalesko, they put together a band to back up Alice and Sammy for the taping of that episode. My friend Kurt Beckman was in that band playing with, I'm sure you might know, Michael Nitro.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Nitro's band, they backed him up on that show. So it was kind of strange that somebody who used to be in Sam Halen was playing with the real guy on the stage that day. It was a great moment for me. It's like, wow, there's my friend, and Michael's my friend, and Scott, I know Scott the drummer, and
right.
It was cool to see them all up there playing with him. It was great for everybody.
That's very cool. And it's cool to have the opportunity to actually, meet Sammy. And did he get to hear you sing it all? Did you sing a line?
No. No. I was asked to be part of a thing last year down in Tucson when he played his show. I had to do a little, I don't know if it's a meet and greet, whatever, at the radio station dressed up. They took us by limo to the show, and we had tickets, so we were down front. And a buddy of mine was jumping over me and pointing to my head, and going, hey, look over here, Sammy. And Sammy comes over and sees me. He extends the mic out to me over the barricade, and I'm like, oh, this is like that kiss moment. I'm taking it. And he whisks it away, and like, sucker! And I was like, oh, you SOB. But I laughed. It was great.
That is pretty funny. That's kind of a cool moment. But you've also done you've had other opportunities to be on television. There was a show called Uncovered, on WB, I think. And that was a cool thing where you didn't have much time to prepare.
I got a call to fill in for them because the singer was not going to be in town. And I literally had 3 days.
And who was that you were filling in for?
It was a band called 68 Guns. I eventually ended up playing drums for them for about a year.
Okay.
And I'd filled in one other time for their singer. And it was strange because they gave you this thing where you had like a minute and 20 seconds to play a song. So in rehearsal, you have to work these shortened versions.
Right.
And we literally had, I had 3 days to work with them and do that and then go do this thing, which, you know.
Was it, filmed for TV.
Filmed for TV, obviously. And that was strange because the promos, they kept showing me singing this Whitesnake song, Still the Night. And I'd walk into some bar and they'd have the sports TVs on and stuff. And that commercial would air and stuff. And it was just, it was surrealistic for me.
That had to be pretty cool, though. Very cool. But, I mean, you've got that voice to front a rock band like that, singing that stuff. I mean, I think it's awesome.
Thanks.
So are you doing any shows right now besides the Sam Halen shows?
I'm not involved in anything else. I'm trying to keep my focus on this. I know a lot of people tend to do a lot of different bands.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really, for the moment, this could change, but I've really been focused on making this my prime motivation and focus.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you've got a lot going on, so that maybe you don't need to have multiple bands, you know?
There might come a point maybe where I might want to do something in addition to this, but right now it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel good about where things are going. I mean, the prospects for what happened with Sam Halen last year versus what's poised for this year, it's another step up the ladder this year, and I really need to keep my directions focused.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Now, when you put a band together, of the local guys for your show, can they tour with you? Can they travel with you if you need to?
I put it out there as far as the Sam Halen thing, like, hey, you're going to need to get a passport because we just went to Cabo in September.
Right.
So yeah. Those opportunities can come at the drop of a hat. You never know. You might have 2 or 3 weeks notice. Usually it's several months in advance.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's a thing to where we're going to have the opportunity to travel. Most of our gigs tend to be out of state.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's designed to be a weekend warrior thing. Everybody's got their day job and whatever they do. But you know, it might be a Friday night in, say, Seattle or something like that. Well, you probably might have to take the day off of work and be able to travel to go do this gig.
Mm-hmm. How old is your son, though?
My son is 12 and a half.
Okay. Is he a drummer by any chance?
You know, it's funny. He actually has really good timing, and he's maybe spent about 10 hours on the drums just noodling around. He has no aspirations to want to play, and that's great because I want him to do whatever he's passionate about.
Sure.
Just because dad did this doesn't mean he should.
Right.
He's really, really into football. Mm-hmm. He's super intelligent. He can talk about anybody in football from Bart Starr and Joe Namath up to guys playing today. I mean, it blows my mind. He's as much into football as I am into music and music trivia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great he's found a passion.
Is he a big guy for his size, for his age?
He's 4'11", and he'll be 13 at the end of July. I mean,
so he's playing in organized football right now.
Right now he's not. He was last year in school.
Right.
I'm not sure what the thing is this year as far as that. He's in choir at the moment at school, which he really seems to enjoy. That was his choice. So hey, whatever my son wants to do, and if he's got a passion for it, I'll support him 100%.
That is awesome. You're also a huge fan of local music scene. I know that you share posts when I'm doing a show and tell people about them, and I see you talk about a lot of other shows. You mentioned in a note that you hadn't seen the Sugar Thieves yet.
I have not. I've seen video.
Right.
But, you know,
you're going to have to go out and check them out.
I do. I mean, I don't get out as much as I should, and there's certain reasons why I don't get out.
Sure.
And sometimes my schedule only permits, like, I don't plan things in advance because either a gig thing or something with my girlfriend and my son may happen. So a lot of times it's a spur of the moment decision where I say, I'm going out. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Right. The Sugar Thieves lead singer, Meredith, is going to be on the show here coming up soon. We're just trying to lock down the date, but I'm looking forward to that. I've been a big fan of the band for a long time and had Michael on a long, long time ago, the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays with such a different style. You know, he plays left-handed and he slaps a lot. Yeah, with his rhythm hand.
No pick?
No, but he bangs the guitar so hard sometimes. The first time I recorded him,
mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm in the control room going, we're going to have a problem. I can't record him. I mean, this that bang is louder than the notes I'm getting out of the guitar. I'll just go ask him not to play like that. And, you know, you can't do that.
Yeah, you're right.
So I went out and I just said, hey, yeah, it sounds great. You know, that thing you're doing, it's like, what? And it's like, well, go ahead and play. It's like, kung, 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 kung. Yeah, that. That's a problem for me. And he's like, well, I don't know what to tell you. I said, okay, cool. Well, you know, if you can soften that up a little. It's just the way I play. I said, all right, great, no problem. I'll do what I can do. But it's such a part of what he does, uh-huh. You know, part of his style. But he's an incredible player, great singer. I mean, the whole band's really kind of very, very, very cool.
I'm curious, how did you work around that?
Well, you don't really. What you do is it's a matter of compression and EQ a little, but then you recognize this is just the sound. That slapping percussion is kind of like an instrument that has a louder aspect. That's just a louder aspect of that particular part. But it works with what they're doing, and mm-hmm. I was unfamiliar with them the first time I worked with them. I was doing a recording show online and bringing bands in, and I wasn't the one booking the bands. And so I would be told, these are the guys, you know, on this week, you know, and I'd bring them in. And we would just have 3 hours to do a record live on this five-camera shoot from the studio.
Right.
And that's where I first met these guys or heard them. I saw them recently at the Rhythm Room where Shay had brought in a whole horn section. And so that was pretty exciting, too.
See, I would love to know about things like that because I didn't get to get a plug-in for our show in the sense that we're doing this show at Prankster's at the Hall
right.
on Saturday, April 15th. We're playing with a Rat tribute band and a Dokken tribute band, and it's a themed event. It's like an 80s hard rock extravaganza. We're going to have
cool.
like an 80s costume contest and so forth.
Oh, cool.
But I really like things that are like, instead of just a band or two in a bar, it's like, well, there's some other things going on. There's a horn section. There's, you know, whatever else is going on. It's like, hey, this is kind of different. I'm into different. I want to check this out.
Well, interestingly, Prankster's is kind of designed for that type of an event, and I haven't seen a lot of them there, but since they have the small stage at one end mm-hmm. and a large stage at the other, you really can start to introduce a whole nother aspect during breaks or during set changes.
Right.
Whether it's a magician or a painter, speed painter, or an acoustic solo artist on the second stage. I've never seen them really take advantage of that, the two-stage setup.
Yeah, I thought about that a little bit, and I was like, I don't want this to get too out of control, so I just decided to keep it focused. So Mike Gobby, who used to be on nights at KDKB, he's going to be emceeing the event for us.
Oh, cool.
He's also going to be doing some rock trivia. We've got prizes we're going to be giving away. There's some other things happening as well. I mean, it really is themed around being an event that is fun and festive.
And are tickets on sale now for that? Are they pre-sale tickets? Or do
I
you
think
know?
It's just at the door. There was talk about something being set up online, and through my contact, I haven't heard that anything's been done yet. So I believe it's just, you know, $5 at the door evening show.
Okay. And if people want to follow you, like on Facebook or connect with you, is Facebook the best spot? Or do you have a Sam Halen band website?
There's a Sam Halen official Facebook page. I can't remember the address to it, but if you put up Sam Halen in Facebook, it'll come up. It's also linked on samhalen.com.
Okay, cool. And why don't we spin another cut of yours off of that solo record you did all those years ago?
Okie dokie.
How about No Greater Price? Remember that song?
I do.
You want to tell me anything about that? If it has any special meaning or experience when it happened?
You know, the whole album that I did, I'm sure you could probably relate to this because you're a guy and you're a musician and you're passionate and creative about what you do. Somehow your experiences and relationships with women can creep into your material.
Creep.
Okay. Over flood, saturate.
Well, I mean, most songs are about relationships. Most
right.
songs.
You know? And I guess my album was, for the most part, money that I probably could have spent on some therapeutic means of being on a couch and talking to somebody, and instead I kind of put it to music. And whether that was the right decision or not, I'm still scratching my head 20 years later.
Now, I think it always is, as long as the stuff you create is good, as long as you enjoy it and felt good doing it and people enjoy it, you know, how can it not be? It gives you, if nothing else, the impetus to write again. I mean, one of my complaints, not to, you know, piss off royalty, but one of my complaints about Paul McCartney's records, he's such an incredible writer, has written such incredible stuff, and I feel like he really needs to put some of that back in the oven these days, that he just doesn't work hard enough, that he thinks because he did it, it's good, it's Paul McCartney.
Because he keeps cranking out stuff, is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, but that isn't as interesting, or it's almost like when Heather and he got divorced, I thought, now we're going to we're going to get a record because now something's going to matter. It's not just a song. There's going to be this extra emotional purpose behind it.
Right.
And that didn't seem to really happen. But sometimes when something matters to you more, you get better work. In fact, one of my best songs that I've written was a love song. And I was just madly in love, and I was working with Dick Wagner on a record, and I was telling Dick, you know, my girlfriend's written all these songs for me, and I haven't written her a song, and I feel bad because I'm a songwriter, you know, and if I'm really in love with somebody, I should be able to write a song. And I said, but I can't now, it'd just be really sappy. And he says, no, now is when you have to, because now is when you'll capture the essence of what it is. You'll never be able to do it another time. Now is when you have to do it.
Right.
Know? And Dick was a huge romantic, you know, he's just way over the top. And so I set out at writing a love song at that time. And it did turn out to be a really, really powerful song, won a songwriting contest, you know? And so it was like, I'm not going to forget that, Dick. Thanks very much. And so when you're motivated, especially emotionally, that is the time to write. That's when it's going to be the most accurate depiction of the feeling. And that's what you want to capture, not to fabricate a story when you're in a comfortable little place and you're not related to it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was absolutely worth it. Trust me. You did the right thing.
Okay, if you say so.
I'm telling you. So let's hear No Greater Price by Steve Christian.
I'm not afraid to
You're listening to Otto D. coming at you live.
And that was No Greater Price from Stephen Christian from Solo Record. Cool song. Very cool.
Thank you.
Are you getting ready to do any other recording? Do you have some new songs?
You know, I've always got little ideas that I record melodies with my phone and this and that and stuff. And I just kind of keep them tucked away because with everything else I have going on and where my focus is at the moment, I'm not looking at that. But something can come out of the blue, which actually happened several months ago. Someone reached out to me and is interested in me doing like a record. And they say they would finance it because they loved my voice, the rock thing. But,
cool.
You know, he wanted me to focus on that. It's like, I'm really focused on the Sam Halen right now. Could I do this on the side? Yeah, sure. Doesn't mean I'm going to do a tour and this and that and whatever.
Right.
But it's always intriguing to think about, yeah, maybe I could do some more songs. Because I'd have to do it if I enjoy it.
Right. Well, you enjoy it, right?
I do.
There you go. Hey, man, thanks for coming in and being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
And good luck at Pranksters on the 15th.
Yes, sir.
7 o'clock doors. 8 o'clock doors.
Yes, sir.
Cool. If I'm in town, I will be there.
Awesome.
All right. Take care.